Hey everyone, on this episode of 6 Degrees with Mike McKenna, I'm joined by somebody who was incredibly important to my career, Lindsay Middlebrook, my first goalie coach, my Bantam coach, somebody who taught me so much about the game. Our careers in the National Hockey League really had a lot in common. We both played 30-something games and really had to work for everything we had. The sound quality on this episode isn't the greatest, but the content is so good. I hope you'll stick in there, listen to it, because Lindsay's got a lot of amazing things and stories. Enjoy.
This is such a thrill to sit across from you and do this.
I mean, how far do we go back now?
No kidding.
30 years, I think.
Okay. I look back at the old outdoor rink at Kirkwood and coming out Michael, get up.
Yep. Well, I learned all my basics from you. I mean, we'll have to go back into our story a little bit, but before we even talk about our relationship, Let me find out about you becoming a goaltender. You're from Ontario to start. And then you ended up making your way to St. Louis University. Kind of an odd path. Yeah. So how did that play out for you?
So I grew up in a with Sega Beach, 100 miles north of Toronto. Youngest of six boys. There was really no organized hockey in this small town. But when we moved to Toronto when I was six, all my brothers were older. So they really didn't have an opportunity to get... Now, they all played hockey, but not as serious. But I was the youngest of six, and they're like, now we're going to get Lindsay into it. And I remember the very first year I played, I started out as a forward. And about five or six games into my first year, our goalie didn't show up. And I remember the coach asking for a volunteer to play goal. And my brother pipes up, Lindsay will do it.
You got forced into it.
And I think that day... I think I had a shutout, but it was because I don't think I had a shot on that whole game.
It's a perfect game. Couldn't have gone any better.
One thing leads to another. The goalie ends up coming back a couple of games later. He ends up leading the league in scoring that year. Now, it's house league, but I end up in goal from there. So I've never really forgiven my brother since. So you do that. You go through youth hockey all the way in Toronto and that. When I was 15, I found out about St. Louis University. A guy that coached me, Sherry Basson. Sherry, he owned the Erie Otters at one time. I don't know if you know Sherry at all or know the name
don't
of
know.
It at all. Okay.
But Erie of the OHL at the time, right?
Yeah. But he, that was after, but he was coaching me in midget hockey. Somehow he knew Bill Selman, who was a coach at St. Louis U. Kind of did some recruiting for him, okay? So I knew about coming to St. Louis the following year to start college. But that year I went to Sudbury. Sudbury Wolves is their first year in existence. And I went up there to camp because I realized that you could go to camp there if you didn't take money or you didn't stay in a hotel or you had X amount of days or something still to keep your eligibility for college. And went up there, no dreams of ever at 15 making it or whatever. But they had a 20-year-old goaltender there, still remember, named Bob Volpe. And they were looking for a young kid to back up and groom. Had a good two or three days there. I remember the guy, Tom Watt, was the Canada coach at one time. He was a coach there and he said, we'd like to sign you and you won't play much this year, but we want to get you ready, whatever. And I remember going home and calling my brother Kyle, and I said, holy shit, they want to sign me. And he's like, get your ass out of there as fast as you can. But I had to go back to this guy and tell him, no, I've got a scholarship or whatever.
Right.
I don't remember what I told him, but I mean, they didn't even want to pay my bus fare back to Toronto. So waited around, played junior hockey that year in Toronto, and then... junior B hockey or whatever, and then went to St. Louis from there. Spent 4 years there, like I mentioned.
What were your thoughts going to St. Louis, though? It's a Division I hockey program, but it was kind of new, and I can't imagine coming from Toronto, you're thinking, I'm going to St. Louis, I'm going to make the NHL. It must have been a different thing in your head.
I don't know if it was, because it's always been, I guess... And I wouldn't recommend this to any young aspiring hockey player, but I always just knew that I just knew I was going to make it to the NHL. and I had a big faith in that, and truthfully put all my eggs in one basket, and I don't recommend that because you look at how many people don't make it. But it, for me personally, it seemed to work out. But we thought, me and my brothers, thought St. Louis would be a great spot because every Saturday night, the Blues, St. Louis Blues played. We played in the same, the Checker Dome or the arena, same as rink as the Blues.
So you were going to get a lot of exposure
so
from this.
So we played Friday night and Sunday afternoon. So you always had teams coming in, scouts coming in to watch the NHL game. Said, oh, we got a college game the night before, whatever. So even though it was kind of new and on its own out there, we thought it was probably the best place to be. And at the time, Emil Francis was a GM at St. Louis. Being a former goaltender, was only 5'6" himself. I thought, hey, you know, this might be the best place for me. Even I had a couple offers from Wisconsin. But the middle of Wisconsin wasn't as accessible to NHL scouts as St. Louis U was, you know. So that was kind of the reason that we picked SLU, just because of what could happen. With that said, jumping ahead, my senior year, they ended up, St. Louis U picked Mike Liute when he was at Bowling Green, where we played against each other all the time. And our stats were very comparable and everything else. And I'm thinking, like, I think you know, you run into the Blues all day long because of being at the same rink as they were. I remember asking Mr. Francis, what, I played against this guy all my life, you know, for 4 years in college, and, I didn't say I owned him, but I had my...
Yeah, you played well against him, obviously, yeah.
And,
there's a pride factor.
And I'm right in your backyard, and how come him and not me? He didn't really even answer, you know, whatever, I don't remember, whatever, but now, with that said, it wasn't a bad choice that he made after all, you know.
Yeah, it worked out.
But, so, that got me in SLU, and then, story I was telling you previously about my senior year, they were kind of pushing me for to be the first All-American on the St. Louis U. So there was a few articles trying to push that. And it was internal. St. Louis U was trying to push it. Big feather in their cap, whatever, stuff like that.
So you had a little juice behind you. For a 5'6 goalie.
Oh, exactly,
was, you know,
exactly.
battling your way through it.
And we had won some... at that time, they only took... To get to the Final Four, they only took two teams from the East, two from the West. We were this new Central Collegiate Division. So... We would go out, we'd beat Boston University, we'd beat all the biggies. I mean, we probably had, if not the best team in college hockey 2 years in a row, top two or three or four.
Wow.
But neither year, when it come down to the votes, did they go outside their two from the East and two from the West. So we're sitting at the end of the year, and three of the four teams that go, we beat during the year.
Yeah.
You know? So we never got a chance to go to the four, but then I, so the senior year comes around, it's my draft year, and I get a call from Atlanta. The guy talks to me, I don't even remember who it was, but he said, hey, we wanted to call and make sure that, one, you'll come if we draft you. And of course I'll come, you know. Said, well, you know, it looks like around the fifth round is where we're looking to slot you. They're great. So going back to that day, that's I can't remember the year, 68, 69, somewhere in there. There were no cell phones, there were no computers, there were no way. The only way you found out about whether you were drafted, unless you were a first round draft pick and they picked up the phone and called you that day or whatever.
You weren't hopping on the internet to find out
later. Yeah. When you're a fifth rounder or lower, you found out, the only way you found out was the newspaper. So the draft was one day. That next morning, me and my brother are sitting in Toronto underneath a lamppost, 5 o'clock in the morning, pitch dark out, waiting for the paper man to come and load up the papers in the paper boxes that they used to have. He comes and bundles them and he puts them in, and I throw my dime in there to get my paper. We open the door, we pull the paper out, scramble the sports section. We opened up, you can hardly see under the light. Atlanta, fifth round, from St. Louis University, Ryan O'Connell. Like, what?
Not Lindsay Middlebrook.
What happened, you know?
How many games had that guy played that season?
Brian played 2 games out of the 42 games that we played. It happened to be one of the 2 games that he played while the scout was looking. And thought he was coming. He was told to come down and look at me. So he assumed that it was me in the net. And
he didn't check the stat pack, obviously.
I guess what? But I have an article from the Toronto Sun that goes into this in detail, and they end up firing the scout, and they called me back.
They drafted the wrong guy.
They drafted the wrong guy, and they called me and told me it was a mistake, and would you be interested in coming as a free agent to camp? And I said, and at that time, I said, well, give me a little bit of time. So we started letter writing, me and my brother Kyle. We wrote every NHL team, every WHA team at the time was still in there.
So you weren't working with an agent or anything. You were doing self-promotion for this.
I mean, no agents, just my brother was my agent.
Yeah.
You know? And we sent out letters, and I remember getting letters back. And I got a letter back from the Vancouver Canucks, and in the letter it had a schedule of their games, a magnetic schedule of their games, and a note, and I still remember the little notepad from the desk of Harry Neal or somebody, I'm not sure who it was. It was a GM, and all it was scribbled in pen. It says, "Try St. Louis, kid, it's closer."
Oh, thanks. That's nice.
And I got multiple other letters, and they were all very professional. Yeah. You know, due to budget cuts, we really can't bring in a free agent, and we'll look further at you or whatever. But then one day, I get a letter from the New York Rangers saying we'd like to invite you to rookie camp. And man, that was the big day. The very next day, I get a letter from the Detroit Red Wings. We'd like to invite you to camp. So now there's a little dilemma here. So it's like, which one? I got 2 out. Which one do you pick?
And they were just invites to camp. They weren't contract
offers.
Oh, no,
no.
So it's not like you had to, negotiate one off the other.
And these were rookie camps. These weren't even the main camp, you know. So which one do you pick? Pick the New York Rangers solely on it came first.
Yeah.
Looking back over the years, and when you finally get on the computers, Rangers happen to have 2 goalies under contract for their, 4 different affiliates, and Detroit had, 9 or 10. So I think if I had gone to Detroit, you probably would have been there for 2 or 3 days and been gone, because they had a lot of guys under contract already.
So you happened into a great scenario with the Rangers.
I
that
lucked
there was
into
an opening.
It without knowing. You know, now you can investigate so much. Now, you know, not only how many years a guy's got left, how much he makes. You know, all these things that come into play when you're a free agent, you're not going to get the benefit of the doubt. You know, and there's a story about Edmonton that will come in later on that. You know, but so I sign that I'd like to come to camp. Train all summer. I go to the rookie camp is in Quebec, some town in Quebec. We go there for 4 or 5 days, and they end up picking 5 guys out of 60 to go from the rookie camp to main camp, and I happen to be one of them.
How many goalies?
There had to be 8 or more, you know.
But you got your foot in the door at that point.
Got my foot in the door. Again, in hindsight, or reading a couple articles, I remember John Ferguson, who was the GM there. I think I reminded him of Gump Worsley.
Think it was due to your height?
Yeah. Hopefully not the weight at that time, but certainly a small little goaltender. You know,
Gump didn't catch with his right hand though,
that's
both
true.
Of us.
Right. You know, but he took a liking to me. Now, you had to stop pucks. You're not going to take a liking to you if you're getting lit up all night.
But
I get to main camp, you know, and it's now I'm from Quebec. They fly us right to New York. And still remember the first day of practice. it's all kind of a whirlwind, and all of a sudden you're going in. First time down the ice is Phil Esposito coming down, and he did something I've never seen before, and he's laughing and everything else, but he comes down and he flips from right-handed to left-handed and roofs one on me, and it was like a zing right in it, you know, like one thing to flip hands and kind of whatever. This guy, like, so, and it goes by me, and I'm like, am I really in this league? Should I even be here? You know, you really, for that moment, question whether you would, maybe I'll just take my gear off and go home.
So how long did it take you to start feeling comfortable, though? I mean, you eventually ended up getting a contract with them and going to New Haven, right?
Right. By the end of the practice, you start stopping them a few times or a lot or whatever, and so it was just a fleeting moment where I thought, "Oh, what am I into?"
Been over my head here,
right? By the end of practice, I can handle it. I can handle my own. I'm not going to embarrass myself, I don't think, you know. So you're in New York, and obviously there's 25 newspapers and reporters and all that, and so it goes. And he has a couple of good scrimmages or whatever, and that to the point where the press is kind of like, who's this goaltender here? You know, no one ever heard of you. You weren't drafted by them or nothing. But he's playing well enough that, you know, kind of like the press kind of embarrassed the Rangers into having to play him. Like, how can you not give this guy a crack, you know? So you get a half of an exhibition game.
So your brother Kyle wasn't feeding him PR, though, right?
Oh, he never told me that. But okay. It wouldn't shock me. It wouldn't shock me. Really. But, I you know, you play, I don't know who you play, maybe the Islanders or something, man, you happen to have a good game. And
the Islanders being that good of a team, right, if you show well against them at that time.
Sure, legitimate, you know. And so I really seem to get some newspapers behind me. You know,
like, the press working for you.
This guy, yeah, exactly, you know, not even realizing it, but they're kind of, I think they're pushing the pressure on. They're like, guy just played really good. You got to give him another game, you know.
Right.
So one thing, you know, I think I get two or three exhibition games. Each one gets a little bit better, and I play a little bit better in it. So it's like the last exhibition of the season, and it's we're playing Washington, and by this time all the regulars are playing.
Right.
So it's really,
it's deep in camp.
Deep, yeah.
And you've stuck along. You've been around the whole time though,
right,
too. I mean, that in itself was something that was going to help you out down the road, not just, you weren't a first cut. I mean, you're sticking around.
Right, I'm down to the wire.
Right.
And there's a little
and
bit
And you still of, don't have a contract yet.
So, oh, no. Now, there's a little bit of talks about, again, one of the reporters, man, you're going to have to sign this kid or whatever.
Yeah.
You know? So, but I let in the first two shots that score. They weren't bad goals, but it was just a factor of two shots, two goals.
Right.
We end up coming back and winning 4-2, but I think that at that moment when I let in the two, figured that was the end of my time, you know. But I finished real strong in the game. We come back to win. We go to practice the next day, and they on the chalkboard is the starting roster for the season. And in that is John Davidson and myself. Doug Sotart.
Yeah. Doug was my GM in Omaha, and his son Denny was my equipment manager in Dallas the last couple of years. Yeah.
So he was the guy they were grooming for the backup job there.
Right.
He had played New Haven for a year or two, and he was being groomed. Gilles Graton was in camp. Swedes were fairly new. Swede named Hardy Astrom was supposed to be this great European guy that was going to come in and stop everything.
And here comes this 5'6" wonder kid out of St. Louis University.
Yeah. And, man, you saw that list. I think I almost fainted when I saw the list. So I'm on a roster to start 2 days later in the very first season game, coming from free agency or a walk-on at rookie camp to making this team. So I go back that night, and in the hotel, I've got a stack of messages. Remember those little pins I used to put papers
in
the stack on?
They still use them in restaurants on put their tickets on them.
Right.
Yeah,
there's gotta be 50 of them on there. Well, 30 of them are agents. You know, and like these guys are like leeches. It's like minute they down the guy that was going to get a contract. They're all over him. So
you were a hot commodity.
Oh, really, really? You know, I was for a week there. I was hanging out. This is the same year of the Maloney brothers.
Yeah.
Donnie Murdoch. Ron Gilbert.
Was Ronnie Duguay there yet?
Duguay was a rookie there.
How was his hair back then?
Oh, long and beautiful. He had the best hair. He was the prettiest guy that ever played the game, you know?
But I'm hanging with these guys.
I'm hanging with these guys. Yeah. We're going to Studio 54, which is a big disco. We're seeing Cher. We got, the artist Andy Warhol. These guys here drinking with, and I think half of them were doing coke at that time.
But
thank God I didn't know anything about that. But just that whirlwind week was just like, is this really happening to me?
Right.
You know,
I mean, it's the New York Rangers too. It's not like you were with the Atlanta
exactly.
Flames, right?
This is the news capital of the world, the Big Apple. Yeah. You know, well, what happens is I back him up the first game, and what I've been told is that the owners of the Rangers were very concerned that how do we in the New York, in the Big Apple, how do we come upon having some goaltender cracking the lineup that we didn't draft, we didn't, you know, whatever. So a day or two later, they had a supplemental draft, and they end up picking up Wayne Thomas because they were afraid or embarrassed, I don't know what word.
Right.
That you got this no-name guy playing for the biggest team in the country or whatever, you know. So within a week, I get sent down to New Haven. So I go down to New Haven, disappointed, but still feeling pretty good about things.
You made
got
the
a
team.
Contract. Christ, you know, the guy said to me, here, talk about money. The minimum salary the year I signed in the NHL was $45,000.
It's about the minimum in the American League now.
That's right, right. Yeah. And I'm thinking, well, if there's anybody that probably deserves the minimum, it's probably me.
Right.
Walk on, and you know, nobody. And I remember Eagleson, my brother Kyle, worked at City Hall in Toronto, and they were knew each other.
Alan Eagleson,
yeah,
Alan infamous.
Eagleson. Yeah,
yeah.
At that time, he was the guy to have. You know.
Right.
He says to me, he says...
Before he ripped everybody off.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
He says to me, he says, what do you think you're worth, or what do you, you know? And I'm saying, you know, pretty much 45, 50,000.
Whatever they'll give me.
He says, what if I can get you 100 grand? Like, you know, holy shit. Where do I sign up with you?
Yeah.
You know? Damn it, if sure enough, he gets me 100 grand in my first contract. But it's not only a two-way, it's a three-way contract. So American League was 16-5.
So he bumped up the top end. He screwed you on the bottom end, probably.
I end up never collecting any money with the Rangers.
Yeah.
So I get 16-5 in New Haven and 12 in the International in Toledo in the American in International League.
But you're still playing pro hockey.
Playing
Your
pro
foot's
hockey.
In the door now, though.
So it's funny because he... When I get sent down to New Haven, now Parker McDonald was a coach at New Haven. He had Doug Sotart for two or three years there. They felt like he got screwed with the Rangers because I got in there. I come back from New Haven. No way he's playing me ahead of his goalie, Doug. Doug plays all the games. I go from making the Rangers roster to not even playing in the American League because of Doug. And the only games I do get are on the road against maybe the toughest team.
You're getting the shit sandwich games.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
Here's the backside of the back-to-back after travel.
Yeah,
when the guys can hardly get off the bus.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And
so that's what led you to Toledo then, right?
But then eventually, so down in New Haven, you got the Swede, Hardy Ahlstrom. You got Joe Gratton, you got Doug Sotart, and me. Gratton's making $200,000 a year just for being there, whatever. I'm the low man on the totem pole. 10 games left in the season, I get sent down to Toledo, and I end up playing there and end up starting right away, and we go and win a Turner Cup that year, you know? So, good finish to a crazy year.
Had to be cool to win a championship there, right?
I mean, you know,
Toledo was a wild rink, too. The old barn with the glass that was like a foot high. I played in it, too.
It
was in existence.
I mean, it was probably the craziest place to play that I've ever played in.
That original Zamboni that you could see the ice coming up and around into the bin.
Yeah. We played the seventh game of the finals at home in Toledo. Had to be 90 degrees because it was probably sometime in. It was like a week before my wedding. When we planned our wedding, figured, oh, May 27th, no problem. But as I kept on moving along, we got closer and closer. I had to fly out of Toledo to St. Louis for the rehearsal dinner and the rehearsal, then back to finish up and play the seventh game. And honestly, it is so hot outside and in that building, and it is filled. They're hanging from the rafters.
Oh, smoking right over the edge, and there's no glass behind the benches. You're sitting in the stands.
By the end of the first period, it is so foggy in there, they've had to stop the game probably six times to everybody get on the ice and skate around to try and clear the fog.
It's like we used to have to do in Granite City or Afton here in St. Louis in youth hockey.
Exactly, you know. And they swear to this day, we're up 4-1 after the first period. Port Huron flags. And Rolly Bouton was the other goaltender the whole time, you know. So we're up 4-1 after the first period. We come out for the second period. There's got to be an inch of water on the ice, and the fog's back in. They think the coach at Toledo, who's a legend, Ted Garvin, they think he pulled the boilers and stopped the ice making.
Turn the compressors off.
We played two periods, and I'm not exaggerating. We had to stop play to skate around 15 to 20 times in this period.
Bro hockey.
They would shoot.
Turner Cup Finals.
Puck would shoot, and there was so much water on it, the puck wouldn't move. You know, it would just stop. And,
yeah.
And like, and we stopped and played. And it took about 3 hours to play this, two periods. And they scored a couple. We ended up winning 4-3 in water. I mean, you didn't want to go down because you guys got soaked.
Right. You know? And your pads used to soak everything up.
Yeah, they're
then.
Now 400 pounds each. Right. So that ended up the first year, so...
What was your equipment like back then? We were talking about it a little bit before we started recording that there was a big fear factor involved in it. It's a lot different than it is today.
Oh, that's the most amazing thing to me is the kids that I coach now. I look at their equipment and they're just like, not only is it light and mobile, but for as light as it is, it's just so protective. These kids are taking shots that would have brought me to my knees. And they flinch them off like it never, ever happened. You know, I mean, I can't remember the last time I had a goaltender coaching a goaltender where he had to come on the net and drop to his knees to fix something or take a shot or whatever. I mean, these guys are invincible now, you know. Back then, man, that stuff there was, it was like cardboard, the shoulder pads, you know. I mean, leg pads, protective back then, you know. I mean, even though they were filled with deer hair and heavy as shit.
Yeah.
They were protective. You never felt shots through them, you know.
But the arms must have been brutal.
The arms and shoulders, and being 5'6", it's really hard to blast a teammate, even in practice. Guy's shooting when he's up under the crossbar. Well, that crossbar is not far from my neck,
right.
You know. So different if you're 6 foot, 6'2", 6'3", you know. My head hovers around that crossbar, so... You can't really rip on a guy too much, like, keep it down.
Yeah.
When they just scored.
I already am down.
So, you put up with it, but it was I would say, you talk about being black and blue, your arms, just constantly, in the inside, above your catching hand, you know, black and blue on this side, elbows above the blocker, just took a beating, and collarbones. I'm so really surprised that you didn't get seriously hurt. I look back with a mask that you wore, old Lefty Wilson mask.
Oh,
that,
man.
Honestly, I wouldn't wear to Halloween, never mind play hockey again, you know. But
And you had some of the famous mask makers too, right? You had a Lefty Wilson.
Yeah, Lefty Wilson.
Who else do you have in your collection at home?
I've got a collection at home. I've got my the guy out of Boston,
Ernie Higgins.
Ernie Higgins. I've got an Ernie Higgins mask. I wore it through college and I think my first year in New Haven. Maybe a couple of years in Winnipeg.
And those were custom made though, right?
Oh, right, right. You had to go there. I mean, still, you think of the you think of the Lefty Wilson. You had to wait for Detroit to come into town to play the Leafs. You had to go to the Maple Leaf Gardens and he took you into the dressing room after the team was out. And he spent all day in there making glow masks for guys who would come in. You'd lay down as the old plaster of Paris all over your face. You
straws in your
Vaseline,
nose.
Vaseline, two straws under your nose and one under your mouth. And you know, sometimes you start to hyperventilate, and I can't get enough air through that straw, right? And this stuff, you know. And as this plaster,
it's like a terrible snorkeling experience.
and as this plaster of Paris hardens, it starts to get hot. So now you're starting to sweat, and now you're starting to like a little panicky in that. But we got through it, and you know, 3 weeks later, you get mask those up in the mail, and I look at it now. I mean, eye holes were huge.
Oh, sure.
The bridge of your nose, there might have been maybe a half inch of material between the two eyes. It only covered your facial line, didn't go up over your ears, over your head or nothing. I mean,
it was really protecting you from getting cut, right?
Yeah.
More than anything else, that was it.
And back then, there was no padding on the inside of those. It was like right up against your skin. So the idea was that it would prevent you from getting cut, but you'd get hit and take your mask off, and that big goose egg would just be way out there, you know? So it wouldn't prevent you from having the big knots on your head from getting hit, but it did prevent the cuts.
Was your Greg Harrison one a little better that you got later in your career?
Yeah, the Harris. Well, the Harrison was the third one.
Right.
That was the combo. That was as good as they make, and I assume, I don't know where the guys nowadays get their combo masks from, but I can't see it being much different than what I had. I mean, they're still got the big steel bars, and they get dented once in a while. You put a new cage on once in a while, whatever. But I think it's probably as good as what they, for the most part, what they're wearing today. The Higgins one, it was small eye holes, kind of like the old Jock Plant mask sort of thing, you know. Down under your chin, way back behind your ears, all the way back. It still had a back plate, but it was a small back plate there, where on the Lefty Wilson one, I mean, the back plate was as big as the front of it pretty well, you know. But you had all the top of your head open and exposed to that, and your ears out and everything, so.
Isn't it crazy to look back on it?
It is.
Like, what was I thinking, right?
Amazing. And then, I mean, as crazy as that is, and that was nuts thinking that's going to protect you. I mean, they say, oh yeah, that was back in the 70s or whatever. Said, 70s, Bobby Hull played with me in the 70s, and I think he shot the puck not too bad, you know. So, right. And then, but take the guys just before me that didn't wear masks. My idol was Johnny Bauer growing up. You look at Sawchuk, Bauer, Crozier, all these guys. I mean, I could shoot a puck hard enough that I could rip your face open with a puck.
Sure.
I mean, a puck doesn't have to be going 15, 20 miles an hour.
Get a little spin on it. It's going
to
cut you wide open.
You know? Never mind 40, 50, 70, 80 miles an hour. These guys taking them. Look at footage of Bauer. He's down, he's out, and all he can do is stick his head in a way to stop a puck, and he does it. You know, down and out. You know? So, yeah, it is what it is because they had no other options. But you look back and it's like, man, how crazy is that? It was nuts just wearing a Lefty Wilson mask. But at that day, that was the best they made, and that was it. So then the Higgins comes along, and that starts to get a little more protective, and I start to get a little bit of foam in there a little bit now. And then you move on to the Paul Harrisons with the cage, and that was a lifesaver. You didn't have to worry about the eyes and stuff anymore. That allowed you to also, we talked about the difference in equipment and being able to dig in when you didn't have to worry about your eyes because of the cage, that allowed you to maybe be a little more confident in the net.
Yeah, so you could actually lead more with your upper body
right.
and your head. And
right, you know, that was my biggest regret in in my whole lifetime of hockey is that I look at the kids that I coach now, I look at the guys that are playing in the NHL now, they've taken the fear out of the game for a goaltender for the most part.
Doesn't take much courage anymore, really.
Other than getting run once in a while or whatever. Yeah. But in general, stopping the puck is not a fearsome thing. When you're a combination of the equipment that I wore in my day and being 5'6", you know, it didn't take long for a, how many times a guy in wind up for a shot. And it's all in practice. In a game, the adrenaline's going. I don't think I ever felt, ooh, I better watch out for this one. But practice, guy winds up from 15, 20 feet out, and all of a sudden you see that puck start to wobble and stand up on end.
Gets your attention in a hurry, doesn't it?
It's coming up around your ears, man. So now all of a sudden, instead of being able to dig in and stay in your crouch, now you're straightened up, now you're back on your heels, waiting. It wasn't like, I don't care if it scores, just don't hit me. You know? Like, trying to bail out as fast as you can. I mean, how many times over the years would you give the guy in practice the whole left side of the net? You'd almost be standing on the right post, give him the whole net, and damn it if they still didn't hit you on the right post. You know, like, you could tell those guys were like, you're not going to score 4 goals all year long. If you can't put it in the open net, you're still hitting me.
No. Those were your hazards in practice.
Right.
Let's flip back to what happened the next year, because you played an entire season in New Haven, which led to your NHL debut. Right. But there were a couple of stops and things that need to happen before you made your debut, right?
Yeah.
So how did the next season and a half go to make that appearance with the Winnipeg Jets?
So I go to training camp the next year. They've got John Ferguson and his group have left. And left New York. Fred Sherrill is now the coach or GM, I believe. I go to training camp, and I don't even get in an exhibition game, and I'm sent down to New Haven
right off the bat making the team
out of camp and
winning the Turner Cup, you're carrying some momentum, and then you're
off,
gone.
Yeah, exactly. You know, goes to show you different management. Different beliefs in goaltenders, whatever.
They got their own guys, too, right?
You know? Yeah. So I didn't even get a sniff. So I go to New Haven, and I remember when I get sent down, I get a call from John Ferguson, who he was going over to Winnipeg, but Winnipeg wasn't coming to the NHL until the following year. They were joining the NHL. He had called and said, hey, look, I heard you got sent down. He said, just go play your ass off in New Haven. And when I'm in Winnipeg next year, I'll draft you and we'll come over to think. Mm-hmm. So that made me feel pretty good. So I did spend the entire year in New Haven. Had a pretty good year. I think I was on the All-Star team or something like that.
Well, let's talk about that for 1 second here. Uh-huh. I mean, I'm looking at your stats from that season. And you had a 3-2-2 and an 8-8-7. And by today's standards...
Right, numbers that aren't good
now. They'd run you out of the league,
right. But
you were an All-Star. And those were probably good numbers.
Right.
You know,
that is funny, and I'm glad you brought that up, because you look at over the long term of the career, I played on 5 different NHL teams, 3 which I considered pretty good teams, and 2 that were brutal. Okay, and I'll take part of that credit for being brutal too. You know, I mean, I was no better than the guys that were in front of me, unfortunately. You know, but. Your stats were all based on things that were so out of your control somewhat. I mean, I went from, let me get it straight, I went from 1 year of having a 5-plus goals against average to the next year of being under 3, and then...
It's not like you went all summer and did goalie camps
I wasn't any better that year than I was the year that I got like 5 in, you know, and it showed by, you know, 1 year after the year I was in Minnesota and had good stats there. Free agent the next year, I probably had 6 or 8 teams interested in me because my stats were good in that. But then, you know.
And at the end of the day, that's all you have is your stats, which isn't fair.
Right.
Like, I always think that goalies are actually less important than people think a lot of the time. You know, like, we can make a difference. We do.
Sure.
But we tend to receive too much credit or not enough credit.
kind of like coaches that you can you can win a few games for a team, and you know, and you can lose a few games, but in general, it's how the team goes for the most part. But you know, it just, and then you go, you know, after I go from Winnipeg, I'm now a free agent trying to find a team. Right. I can't find anybody that wants me.
Because Winnipeg wasn't very good.
Right. No, we were an expansion team, and we weren't. And then, you know, so you go from a bad team, and nobody wants you the following year, to playing on a good team, and having multiple offers the following year. Back to New Jersey, which was an expansion team coming over from Colorado.
Right.
We were terrible. I was terrible.
Gretzky so lovingly referred to it as a Mickey Mouse organization.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
That, you know, there's a story to come shortly about the Detroit or the Jersey experience, which I need to relate to you. But just how your belief, people believed you were either good or bad, depending on where you were. And it was so unfair because years that I was wanted by multiple clubs, I don't know better than that guy was letting in five a night in Winnipeg.
And I always
had some good defense in front of you. You know?
I kind of felt this too, though, with my career, that I look at the NHL teams that I played with, and I really only played on two out of the seven teams I actually played games with at that time were any good. Dallas, Columbus.
Okay.
Where were my numbers the best? Where did
Dallas,
I actually
Columbus.
Have a chance?
Right,
you know,
right,
and
right.
You know, Tampa, we were falling off the map brutal.
Sure,
and then,
sure.
You know, last year in Ottawa, quite frankly, the worst defensive team in Advanced Dance history, you know, and not on players in any way, it's just the reality of it.
Sure,
so
sure.
I always look back at it and thought, man, if I just would have had a real opportunity, like, I mean, like a 20-game opportunity with a good team, could I have grabbed hold of that and became a full-time regular guy, you know? Did you have that same feeling?
Well, the exact same thing. Mine was when I went to Minnesota. I went there, had a good training camp, started off well. I got sent down. Joe Malosh was the number one guy. Donnie Beaupre was a rookie. I think if I'm not mistaken, they kept the three of us for quite a while. Played a game or two. Got sent down to Nashville, Tennessee in the Central League. Played really well there. Had a good year there. Late in the year, I get called up. Originally when I went down to drove down from Minnesota to Nashville, I get to the rink in Nashville, and there's a note saying, Donnie Beaupre broke his arm, he'll be out for 6-8 weeks. Turn around, get back in the car, and drive back to...
Was a note, like, taped to the door of the arena when you showed up?
It was in...
Hey, Lindsay, turn around.
You turn. You know? So, I go back there, and it's great. Now, I think 21 games, I sit behind Joe Malosh, and he's playing great, and the team's doing well. Couldn't expect any different, you know? But, so then I get, once Beaupre's better, I get sent back down. Then at the end of the year, I get called up, and I end up playing a couple games and playing pretty well, to where the coach, can't think of the coach at the time, and the coach comes to me and says, listen, Lindsay, we're gonna start you in the first game of the playoffs. And this is when, you know, Jill's there and Beaupre's there and I'm getting a start. So I'm playing the second last game of the season against the Hartford Whalers. And guy comes down the wing and guy comes down, he takes a shot, I drop into a butterfly, rebound comes out, second shot, shoots and it scores on the rebound. I try to get up and I can't get up. There's something wrong here. I've never been injured in my whole life, and something's wrong with the knee. So I slowly get up, then go back to center and face off. A couple of minutes before the action comes down again, guy comes down the wing and he shoots one to the far post. I go to move and it's locked. I can't go. Then they realize that something was wrong. I get carted off the ice with game before the playoffs starts.
Man.
That's where I think, man, if I had just got my feet wet in the playoffs, you might have made a name for yourself that might have turned it. So you can play all you want during the season and stuff, and maybe, but come playoff time is where you get that national exposure and that. And
especially then without the day of the internet.
Right, exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Papers start picking up everything that's happening.
So that was the one regret. I wish I had, the only time I had a chance to be in the playoffs, I got hurt. And it turns out it was an orthoscopic surgery. It was, So the next, but I was a free agent then. So it ended up not being able to play. But I'd had good enough stats in a few games that I played that with New Jersey coming into the league, they offered me a guaranteed spot as one of the two goalies and a pretty significant pay raise. So it was a no-brainer there.
Yeah.
Now, you run into what I just got out of in Winnipeg. When I look back, got back in another expansion team.
Yeah.
And it's like, but just the excitement of having a spot to play in the NHL, guaranteed. So Chico Refs was the number one guy.
Yeah. What was Chico like as a goalie partner? I got to ask really quick.
Chico was very good. He's
one of my favorite people in the game to talk to
now. He is always happy-go-lucky, but he was intense, and I was still young enough and rookie enough that I wasn't intimidated by him, but I guess I was very respectful of him, so
sure.
I didn't feel like we were equals or that. You know, I was there to try and help out, whatever, but he was great to me, but it wasn't like we were hanging together, you know.
Yeah.
He was the number one guy, and that was fine, you know. But again, no matter how good he was, he wasn't very good, and he's getting lit up regularly.
And a guy who was really good with the Islanders before that.
Right,
hey,
right.
Plenty of good goaltender.
Sure, yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, you don't have it in front of you, it's not going to happen. So
that year probably went a little sideways then, I guess, being with Jersey, right?
Yeah, so I'm there in Jersey for most of the year. And then one day we're fly to Quebec and we're playing the Nordiques. Now, before we went there, I hadn't played in about 10, 12 games. And they come to me and said, we want to get you back in the net, you know. Let's look at the schedule and where it works, you know. They had planned on me playing Hartford, who wasn't a very good team at the time. Get you back, get your feet wet, okay. But before that, we were going on a Canadian tour. I think we had Toronto, Canadiens, and the Nordiques. Chico plays against the Leafs, so we lose 7-1 or something.
Close game.
Yeah, another close one. A typical game. Close for about 3 minutes into the game. He goes back and plays against the Canadiens, and we lose 5-6-2 or something.
Getting closer.
He starts against the Nordiques. We come in after the skate at the beginning of the game, and Billy McMillan's the coach. He comes and says, Chico's not feeling well, you're going. So, you know, kind of a last minute. I hadn't played for a month, you know. Now you find out 3 minutes before game time. And it's against the Nordiques, who in Quebec, probably were the toughest team in the NHL. That had all the Stazzies at that time, Goulet, Michel Goulet, and I mean, they were
good club.
These guys tended not to show up on the road a lot, but at home in their French crowds and that,
right?
That's not a place you wanted to play.
Yeah,
I get in there, and if memory serves me well, they have like 22 shots in the first period on me, but we're up 1-0. Have a great first period, you know. 5 minutes into the second period, they've scored three out of probably six shots, whatever. I get the hook. I'm like, what do you want from me, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, so reporters after the game coming to me in the dressing room, and I've never been shy in what I would say, and I said, you know, and I kind of feel like I was thrown to the wolves here. I said, you know, we had a game plan for Hartford. Then all of a sudden, 2 minutes before game time, I find out, you know, play a pretty good first period, let a couple in the second, get the hook. Kind of feel like, you know, whatever. So that paper the next morning comes out, you know, Middlebrook's thrown to wolves or something, you know.
Yeah.
We're on the plane back, and Billy McMillan grabs the paper and shoves it in my face. He's cursing me up and down about what I said and stuff like that. And I get back to New Jersey, and a day later I'm traded to Edmonton.
No kidding. So just being honest to a fault, really.
Yeah. I mean, it's just how I felt. You know, maybe it was wrong to voice it, but
heat of the moment. Anything else?
You know, when you're struggling to play and make it. So anyway, so I get, so I find out. So after we come back from Quebec, we don't play for in New Jersey. We don't play for another 4 games, and then we're gonna 4 days, and then we're gonna play Washington. We're gonna take a train from New Jersey to Washington to play. But we got 3 days off, so me and the wife, we head out right after we come home. I'm pissed off because I got pulled and whatever. So we go to New Haven. We played New Haven the previous couple of years. Had some friends in New Haven. Me and the wife head out to New Haven for a day or two. Well, at that time, again, how do you get a hold of someone? No cell phones. Nobody knew where we were.
And you had 2 days off. Like
2 days off, yeah, right?
Go be a normal human. Get away from the rink.
Right. Yeah. Well, that morning I get traded, but they can't get a hold of me. Nobody knows where I am. I've got Mike Kitchen and John Wensinker, live in the next townhouse to us.
Wow.
But they didn't even know where I'd went. You know, I didn't think I'd have to tell anybody. I got 2 days off, you know.
You didn't need permission.
Right, you know. So we come back like 2 days later. I guess John Wensink and Kitchen saw my car out in the garage or in the driveway, whatever. They come over. They've got a newspaper. Middlebrook traded to Edmonton, whatever. 2 days later. So by 2 o'clock in that afternoon, I'm on a flight to Hartford to play with Edmonton. Wife's at home. We got a house, townhouse. We got 2 cars. We got a dog. Don't have any kids yet, so we're lucky there.
Yeah.
But it's like, hey, honey, I got to run. You know?
They might as well trade you to China, literally, if you're going to Edmonton that far away, you know?
Exactly.
And by the way, I just spurred my memory, though. Where'd the nickname come from?
China Wall?
Yeah.
I know she will.
That was...
I have no idea where it originated for you.
China Wall, when I had that crazy week in New York where you were kind of the talk of the town for a while. Frank Beaton, I don't know if you know that name. Frank Beaton, his middle name was Never. But Never Beaton?
No.
One of the toughest guys that ever played. Played for the Birmingham Bulls. And you would think the story...
This is a hockey team, not a baseball team, folks.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You would think that this guy would have been like 6'8", 280. The stories about him on fighting in hockey, I mean, this guy was legendary in our year, you know. He ends up, he's with the Rangers, too. I meet him, and he's like 5'8", 5'9", 165.
He's just a certified maniac.
But when he gets in a fight, the old eyes start to roll up in his head, and it's like, you're scared shit before you ever land a punch against this guy, you know. And he can take a shot, you know. I mean, you can hit him 5 or 6. He don't care. But he's going to get you, you know. And so he somehow come up with the China Wall nickname for me in training camp. And, you know, that was also Johnny Bauer's nickname.
Right, I knew that.
And that, so I don't know, maybe in the time frame I had told him about Johnny Bauer, I don't remember, but somehow the China Wall nickname stuck with me throughout, you know.
Would guys actually call you Wall or Mr. China,
hey, China
or anything like
China,
that?
China, how you doing?
Would they really?
Yeah, China, yeah. Exactly. So, yeah, so that one stuck, and that stuck for... 2 or 3 other teams that I went to.
Incredible,
you know?
Yeah. So, I had it on my mask in New Jersey when I did the tribute mask with you
and
Chico.
Way, that was the coolest thing that's ever happened to me.
Well, and
what a great tribute. And, man, I showed the family it brought you to tears sometimes.
What was so cool about it was that, you know, it's a good time to kind of talk about our history together, really, too. I mean, you ran and started the first goalie school that I can remember in St. Louis that was really based here, that got all the young kids into it. And I learned all my basics from you, from positioning to skating, all that stuff. I still checked my post the way you taught me to, you know, when I was a kid. I mean, when you retired to St. Louis, did you expect to do stuff in hockey and to help out the younger kids as they were moving through?
I don't know about a goal school necessarily. I was thinking more about coaching.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to coach a high school team or something like that. But I do think at that time you realize that, man, there's just nothing out there for these kids. So it was brought on by by a necessary thing, right. Not because I necessarily thought of that idea first. It was kind of the cart before the horse. It was sort of like a bunch of horses out there, now they need a cart, you know. Right. So, but yeah, you know, that went for, I don't want to say 17 years we did that. And we had years where we had three sessions going. We probably had, at one time, 55, 60 goaltenders.
And this is in St. Louis. Louis. Right. Late 80s, early 90s. Yeah.
And, man, there was girl goalies. There was kid goalies. We had a married couple that were both goalies, a man and a woman that both played senior hockey as goalies. We had everything you can imagine, from really weak to really good.
For something that you never really expected to do like that, what was the feeling like when some of us started to go on to play pro in college and on in hockey?
You know, it is so satisfying. Until it happens to you, you can't even explain. Kind of like getting married or having a baby, you know. It's hard to explain just how wonderful those things are. But to see guys, I mean, I still remember you, Mike, and all the way through Kirkwood and all that, but I still can't. It's like it happened yesterday. Was the Kamloops tournament?
Yeah.
You know, I mean that there is still as vivid in Kamloops, British Columbia. We took a team from St. Louis, Missouri. That no one, everybody was pissed off because how did they get in the tournament when all these teams from Toronto and all over Canada couldn't get into this tournament? And you know, we walk through, we win a few games, and next thing you know, we're in the final game against Little Caesars.
Honey Bake. We were playing against Chris Connor, who was my teammate last year.
Okay. Oh,
I mean,
yeah?
Yeah, I still get goosebumps thinking about this.
You ever talked to him about that?
Oh, yeah, we talked about it. I was actually watching the video of it this summer. And I sent him a quick video of it. You got to send me the whole thing because he didn't have it anymore.
Okay.
But this is 22 years ago, yeah, and I'm still getting goosebumps thinking about it. You know?
And man, we just we end up. And remember, before the game, the day before, when they found out that we won, and they were like, "Oh, this is in the bag. We've got the championship," and they were almost partying already, thinking that, "Oh, we got a St. Louis game," you know. And I don't know if we got down a goal or two.
We were down two and came back.
And then we came back, and I think it was a 5-minute penalty that changed the game. And then for the last 3 minutes of the game, the puck never left our zone, our zone. They were peppering you left and right. And
we did it, though.
You did it, and yeah.
So much
then
fun.
Then I look on Facebook, and I see Chris Bentler on the Facebook a lot.
Yep.
And I think back... he's the one that went through the glass pane.
He did. Yeah, so we had a guy on our team named Chris Bentler. He's going to love it that we tell this story. But we go to Kamloops for the most prestigious Bantam hockey tournament in the world. And this kid goes through a plate glass window, nearly cuts his arm off, and he can't play in the tournament.
A buddy of his body checked him into the building. It happened to be a glass building. I remember this big glass pane of glass broke. And the big piece from the top of the window come down just like a guillotine.
Yeah.
And slice his arm up. And I remember we're sitting in having dinner at a restaurant, and one of the guys running down, and coach, Chris is cut, he's hurt. Da, da, da. And we run over from dinner over here, and by this time there's right across from where he got cut, happened to be some kind of EM emergency room, yeah. Something. They had a doctor or a nurse come over and help. But man, he was crazy. He was in rough shape. But here's a kid. We hadn't even played our first game, and we already got our injuries, you know. So
we had to grind. I mean, for people that don't know, though, the Kamloops tournament really is the most prestigious Bantam tournament. And for us from St. Louis, I think it really put us on the map as a hockey city. I think when you look back, our team winning Kamloops, and then a few years later, I think it was McInnes who went and won the Pee Wee tournament with those kids.
Okay.
I think those two things really are what put us on the map. You know, because it was our age group that started to put players out into pro. And, you know, there'd been college kids before, but not draftees like us.
Right, exactly.
And I felt like that had a lot to do with it.
Yeah, I agree totally.
Going back here, we kind of glossed over it, but you had an interesting experience in Winnipeg. You were telling me earlier about the fitness testing that they had there and just how difficult some of that was back in the day, and it didn't really relate to goaltending at all.
So, you know, you get drafted by Winnipeg when from New York, so that when the NHL joined, when WHA joined the NHL, everybody had to protect their rosters, so they had a draft for the new team for Winnipeg. Claim to fame, I was drafted in the second round to Winnipeg. Bobby Hull was in the third round. Now Bobby Hull, Bobby was 64 years old.
We're not going to mention that.
But
it doesn't matter.
Fact is, every time I see him occasionally. Oh, yeah. You ever make it?
Yeah.
So, he's a fun guy. I've always... and then when Brett Hull comes along, I get to know Brett a little bit. And because of the tie-in with his father, they've always been very nice and friendly. Two stories. So back to Winnipeg. One of the very first things that was sent to me was the training that goes on for the season in the summer. And we all had to, the coach at the time, his name was Tommy McVie, and he had we had to run a actual mile in under 5 minutes. Now, to me,
that's 5 minutes.
I think professional runners hadn't hit the 5 minute mark.
I mean, yeah, that's like the Kenyans hadn't hit that yet, you know?
Yeah. It's like 5 minutes. Here I am with legs that are 29-inch inseams.
What size were your pads?
Oh, 29 or 30.
Right, exactly.
I think they're still juniors, like intermediate. So, but I spent all summer long, every single night, trying to run this mile.
Not worried about training for hockey. Worried about trying to run fast.
Worried about stopping pucks.
That's the silliest thing.
That didn't bug me at all, you know. I was confident enough that I thought I could stop some pucks, but no way I'm going to get this. So we get to Winnipeg the first day. We show up. We go to the rink. We get in our shorts and T-shirts. We walk across the road to the football stadium where the Blue Bombers play. We go through the hallway out to the field. And I look up, and there's like 8,000 or 9,000 people in the stands have come to watch this McVie Mile. It's not the first year he had done it. He'd done it for 2 or 3 years in the WHA there. So it drew a crowd of people to watch this. So now I walk
up. This is a rescue disaster.
I already know that the best I ever done was 5:38.
And that's hauling ass.
And that's, for a little guy, for a big guy, that's hauling ass. For a little guy, I had wings on or something, wind-aided or something, you know. But so now I'm shitting bricks because it's like, how bad am I going to look here if I, you know, can't do it, whatever. So we get out there. Well, it's kind of, you know, Winnipeg, one of the windiest cities outside of Chicago, might be the windiest city in the world.
That's what they always say, downtown, that one corner where there's like the four streets. It's the windiest corner in all North America.
We go out there and the wind is howling. So they've got it on an oval, but the oval's not oval around the football field, but it's not exactly a mile. So they've marked off exactly a mile. What they did is they put flags where you had to run around, okay? Well, you start off 30 guys at a time. They run down as fast as you can. You get to this corner, everybody's almost got to come to a stop. It's like going behind the net in training camp. 40 guys trying to make a turn. That's an L-shaped turn. Like, guys are running in. It's like an old marching band that runs into the street corner. You know, like, these guys are tripping over each other, stumbling.
It's like Formula One cars piling into turn one, you know?
Go to the second turn. Okay, you're still going okay. Coming back the back way. Now you're against the wind. Coming down the first one, you're flying. The wind's at your back, blowing. Hey, yeah, okay. Little back up in the corner. Now you're coming down the far side, and you got 40 mile an hour winds in your face, and you're going, but the legs aren't going. I'm not advancing anywhere.
Well, you got a parachute on.
It's not going anywhere, man. Finally, get down there.
Were the people in the stands cheering?
Oh yeah, they're rooting you on. It's like it was like a Stanley Cup game, you know. And either rooting or laughing. I couldn't tell the difference. But the good news is I wasn't alone. You know, when it finished, and I think there was two groups of 30 went. Well, they didn't post any scores. They had all the brass gets together, and it took about 10-15 minutes. They announced over the public speaking thing, due to wind conditions, we're going to take 30 seconds off of everybody's time because none of the I think one guy out of the 60 made it at the 5 minute mark.
Yeah.
Most were 5 to 5:30. You know,
it's still moving, man.
You know, so they end up with that 30-second deduction that they took off. I think I was still at 5 minutes and 40 seconds. So it would have, you know. So here it is. So the next day, the first three or four draft picks: Peter Marsh, myself, Bobby Hull. Can they get a fourth guy? Headlines in the Winnipeg paper the next morning: draft picks make mockery of McVie Mile. None of us could hit the 5 minute mark. Okay.
And they're including Bobby Hull in this?
Yeah, yeah. Now he's 52 or some shit. You know.
Yeah.
And they're still. It's like, so I haven't even put the pads on to stop a puck yet, and I figure I'm out of here.
I'm in one. Yeah.
So that was that, and yeah, just craziness. So you go back to having to be in shape, or you know, and even before my day, they used to come to camp to get into shape.
Right.
Now I know it's changed. Guys are playing year round or working out year round.
And a lot of guys had summer jobs back then, right?
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah,
that was normal.
If you're going to work out, it was because it's 8 at night because you're working till 5 or 6, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, not quite the same. Not like you had the luxury of belonging to a gym or stuff like that either, you know? So so we got through it, but it was certainly it was a wake-up call then, and I don't know if they had it. I think that might have been the last year they had it because I think the embarrassment of nobody being able to make it. So.
When you got to Edmonton, there was a lot of strong personalities there and really legendary players. I know you weren't there long, but what was it like to walk into that locker room right at the peak of when they were hitting their stride?
You know, it you talk about going from, in Winnipeg, coach believed that what made him a good coach is that he spent 24 hours a day at the rink. You know, I mean, that was his idea of, like, dedication to the game. Mm-hmm. Well, one, you saved on rent from getting an apartment, I guess, but, you know. But didn't mean that you were a better coach or that. We would practice for 2 and 3 hours at a time in Winnipeg during the season.
Oh.
To the point where guys were dead and gassed and pissed off and everything else. Biggest thing I found when I got traded to Edmonton, very first practice, 45 minutes tops, everything was just flying. The fastest practices I've ever seen. It was line rushes up and down and just full game speed. But if you're going full game speed, you can't go much more than 30, 40 minutes.
Right.
And be gassed. And they were great. I mean, those practices never lasted, lucky they're an hour. And they were just fast and going. So, you know, you look at the different, why was Edmonton so good? Not just because of that, but different theories in how to handle people and that. So going to Edmonton, yeah. Stepping on the ice and you got Messier, Curry, Coffey, Gretzky. I mean, those guys, you know, it's like, still like, what am I doing here? And by that time, I'd been around for a while, so I shouldn't have been quite as in awe as I was. I mean, you go to Winnipeg and, you know, back to Bobby Hull in Winnipeg. Every time we go on the road, you'd have to wait 3 hours on the bus because Bobby was out signing autographs. And he would never turn anybody down, so everybody else on the bus like, come on, guys, let's get going. You know, we got a plane to catch or whatever. And so, you know, then you go to Edmonton, lucky enough to be part of it for a couple of months. And I remember going to an autograph signing session in West Edmonton Mall, which is the biggest mall in Canada at the time. We get a couple miles to the mall. And they got traffic cops out there directing traffic, and it just looks like downtown New York City with the traffic, just for this signing thing. So they've got three players to a lunchroom-sized table spread out through the mall, and lines for each one. And honest to God, here I am, a nobody, just got traded. Nobody knew you were even been traded, probably. But I never stopped signing autographs from probably 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock in the afternoon. You didn't even have time to look up and see who was handing to the paper. And again, having a name like Lindsay Middlebrook wasn't like Al Smith or something, you know.
You got a long name to sign.
It took a lot of ink.
Did you ever shorten it up?
I started just
LM33. Yeah. I had a quick one that was like two M's together, 56, when I was really in a hurry. So I had two signatures.
Yeah, there you go. That's like the arms falling apart, the hands cramping up and everything else. But just like, this thing was the biggest thing going on in Canada that day. It was like, but again, Gretzky, Messi, Curry, Coffee, you know, Huddy, I mean, the list goes on, you know, to watch them perform and one to have played against them. And when I was in Winnipeg, I was fortunate enough to, I think one of the games I won was against Edmonton, if I'm not mistaken. And I believe that Gretzky had a breakaway late in the game. And he come in and he let one go and it hit a knob on my stick. And
hit the flagpole.
That was back when I had like a whole roll of tape on my knob.
Yep.
And it rang off it and went off and we ended up winning it or whatever. And like, so then, but I am a list, I am on his list of having been scored against. So I feel like, okay, me and about 200 other goaltenders that he scored on, at least I'm in that pile.
You're in the club.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, you mentioned your stick, and that's the one piece of gear I wanted to talk about, because yours was really unique, and you had a cutoff portion of it on the bottom side of the paddle. What was your reasoning for that?
It allowed me to, I think, which I didn't do a lot, but paddle down a little bit more, probably even then. It allowed me... We never ever turned our hands over to shoot.
The Turco style grip, they call it now. No, you hold it like a normal player.
Yeah, my catching glove was down there.
Right.
So when he had that piece before, once I cut away the backside, it sat in my glove a little bit better.
Yeah.
And I was never, we didn't play the puck in general too much in my day. We had a few guys that could, but in general, I was just mediocre at it. So in order to get any better, you tinker with stuff. And it seemed to help a little bit and got my glove in there a little bit better, a little more solid. And so I was able to maybe hit the glass and get it out of the zone sometimes or whatever. Never mind scoring goals.
Yeah, the old Victoriaville sticks, though. And
exactly.
I loved it that you used to keep them on the shelves when you worked for a sporting goods store here in St. Louis.
We threw in all the Brodeurs and all the Patrick Waugh's and all those. Oh, by the way, here's some Middlebrooks.
Yeah, but you'd find this whole section of kids from St. Louis, they had a cutaway on the backside of their sticks.
Right,
I still have offset shoulders on mine. I don't have it quite as extreme as yours was, but it's kind of the same thing. I played with it, and mine was actually a pro-return Grant Fuhrer.
Okay.
Because his shoulders were a little bit off on that, too. So guys used to tinker all the time, though, back then.
Michael, you were such a equipment guru or whatever you want to
nerd,
say.
Geek, nerd, you take your
whatever.
Pick. Yeah.
I never seemed to be into it. They said, you know, were you superstitious? I'm sure there was times I laid my gear out and did you put your left one on first or whatever? I don't remember if I did or not. I may have, but it was probably subconsciously. It wasn't like,
you didn't have
I got
to do
the
it.
Right, you know, whatever. The only thing I didn't like was once I had my stuff laid out, I didn't want anybody touching it. Guys are coming and mess with you, you know, kick the pad over a little bit or something.
Yeah.
You wouldn't know who it was, but you get so pissed off, so mad. That was about as far as you got, you know, quirkiness for equipment or whatever. But I was one of the first guys to ever wear a nylon-faced bowl pad.
Oh, yeah.
And Cooper made it for me. Living in Toronto, Cooper Factory was in Toronto at that time. And I'd go there and they were talking about getting pads lighter. It was still deer hair inside.
Right.
But at least the face was nylon.
Yeah. They were experimenting with new materials, lighting them up.
Right.
They weren't natural leathers.
Right, right. Just trying to get a little bit lighter.
Yep.
But I do remember taking them to somewhere in Toronto to try out the pads, but they had done the whole face in nylon and even on the inside. So you go down and push off and die, you'd be sliding. I find myself in a corner, you know, you couldn't stop on these things there. Yeah.
And that's what we're looking for now.
We want that,
because it's changed so much in how we push when we're down, and the skates are completely different.
Yeah.
It's amazing how technology's changed.
I know we're jumping all around, but I saw one of my goalies, I didn't realize the goal skates now are basically forward skates.
There's no cowling anymore.
Yeah. I'm like, holy.
I mean, there's still some guys in the NHL that are using cowlings, but we're at the point now where I don't think you can even buy one anymore in a store. So all the kids have them. In 5 years, we won't see a cowling any longer.
And the days of ever taking a puck off the toe, is a pad completely...
pad covers out, you still get them off the toe, but you don't ever take them to the inside of the skate like you used to.
No, the skate saves are over, right?
Yeah, but I tell you what, I can still do it. You taught me how to make skate saves, and if you put 20 pucks at the blue line and tell the guy to put them on the ice, I can still do it. And there'd be days in practice that I would.
Do it.
Because the younger guys can't do this stuff. They never learned it.
They're looking at you like,
and they'd look at me and I'd go, yeah, you got to go forward and C-cut and move out to the side. And it blew their mind.
Going off
yeah. And you'd have the puck shooting machine out there cranking them up, and we'd be kicking them out.
Buddy.
I loved doing that, though. You know, like, I wouldn't use it in a game any longer because it had passed by. But from a young age, I can still do that stuff. Again, going back to the things I learned from you.
Let me ask you, why do you think the art of poke checking and sweep checking is gone?
Great question.
I mean, I know the game has changed, but how many times... I would come down on a breakaway, and I'd slowly be backing into the net. And this guy, when do they make their deke? A lot of times if they're deking you, they're only a foot from you. So, like, you didn't even have to poke it. You just had to kind of leave your stick there, and they'd run right into your stick half the time, these guys, you know? But I never see poke checks anymore. Once in a blue moon.
Yeah.
But, and I know the paddle down has come in, and that, but that stick still should be a much more a weapon.
I think it's incredibly underutilized now. And I think it's because so many of the kids believe in their structure and how they save pucks and their technical ability that having an active stick isn't something they even think about anymore, and they're not taught because they move so efficiently now and seal the ice that, I mean, we used to have to cut pucks off too because we couldn't get to the backside, right? So you knew if the puck got past to the other side, if you didn't cut it off, you were gone.
Right.
And now these kids all think that they've got a chance to
get
there.
Over there. Okay.
And it drives me nuts, though, because I see the exact same thing, where there's a guy a foot, 2 feet away, and I'm just going, get your stick involved, attack that guy. Yeah. And you'll still see Fleury do it, Ryan Miller do it.
Okay.
You know, some of the older guys, and some young guys, too, have the ability. But I don't think it's taught like it was. I mean, it used to be something that we did awful lot.
I mean, it was such a... To me, it was such an important part of my game.
Yeah,
I learned it from Johnny Bauer and Al Smith, two goalies that mastered it, and it was just so effective for me.
Yeah,
and I know the game's changed and everything else, but man, there's so many. I see so many goals today where if they did use a stick like I used it, they could have made that save, or they could have prevented that pass across, or the guy thrown out from behind the net out to the slot. You're picking it off or whatever.
It drives me crazy, but it's also funny in practice when I hit somebody with a poke check. Players actually get pissed now.
They think,
they're like, what are you doing? I'm like, I poked it off your stick. Sorry, buddy. Like, don't bring it into
you can't do that.
Don't bring it into my house.
Right.
You wouldn't do that in a game. Oh, have you watched video of me, bud? Like, I understand you're 22, but I've been doing this for as long as you've been alive here. Like, this is part of my game, You'd hit guys with it, and they'd just freak out.
That's funny.
So when you got later in your career here, and Edmonton was the last time you had in the NHL, what drove you out of the game? Did your body start to give up on you? Did you feel like it was time to transition? What made the decision
for you? I think one of the facts was that I'd run out of NHL teams that wanted you, showed interest. You know, you'd played for five different GMs, five different teams that, and I wasn't getting the feelers, went to Toledo, back to Toledo for a year. Then I think I was in Milwaukee for a couple of years or whatever. And I do remember, by that time we'd had, in when I was in Edmonton, I got sent down to Billings, Montana. Played in Billings,
Hockey
Montana.
Hockey hotbed.
Back in the 80s. It was like...
I think what league was it in? What league was that? Central?
Central Hockey 8.
Yeah.
But the funny thing was... The big awakening there was after our first league game, half a dozen guys and their wives went downtown, which was downtown Billings. Was a
couple saloons, right?
Yeah. We walk into a saloon or a bar restaurant, and they literally got open gun. Like, they're sitting there, and there's four guys, and they all got their pistols out on the table. Like, it's like we're coming from civilized country where... I don't know that I've ever seen a gun, never mind.
Literally the Wild West for you, right?
Wild West, we all have shirts and ties on suits, and they're all in jeans and cowboy shit. And it's like, it kind of like the old Animal House movie where they walk into that bar and, can we dance with your women?
Can we dance with your dates? Yeah. Otis! They love us!
My man!
Yeah.
And we're just like, okay, I think we better just turn around, get out of here. So... So I got off track there.
We're talking about your transition out of the game, though.
So I get to Milwaukee, and by this time, Montana was when my daughter Ashley was born.
Yeah.
And so by this time, we got a daughter that's 4 or 5 years old or whatever. Playing there, knowing that I'm near the end of the line, not getting any other interest or that. Still love the game, but once you don't have that drive to be at the top level, kind of diminishes a little bit. I remember going to the training camp after the second year, and Phil Whitliff was the gentleman that was the coach in the Milwaukee Admirals, and he wants to sign me for a 2-year contract for peanuts or whatever, you know. And I said,
enough to make a living, but is it really worth continuing?
Right.
Yeah.
But I said, why don't we just sign for 1 year and we'll go from there? Well, for some reason, he took a fucking big offense to this. Like, almost insulted that I'm offering 2 years and you're only taking one. Like, nobody does that. I don't know why, because let's...
And you were honest with him. Yeah. Yeah.
Again, honesty
yeah.
sometimes can get you sent to the minors.
I guess so, right? Yeah.
But then he withdrew the offer totally. Mm. Won't take two, nothing.
He's
so I went home and told
you.
The wife what went on. And at that time, I just said, hon, I think...
Because you had a great year in Milwaukee.
Yeah, you know. I think I'm just ready to call a night. Let's pack it up and go. So, phone the back said, "Hey, thanks for the no offer, and we're out of here."
And then you ended up in St. Louis.
Ended up, and that was now it's just, okay to St. Louis or Toronto. You know, right. I mean, I'm from Toronto, and she's from St. Louis. We had a home here in the off season in St. Louis. St. Louis, not a bad mouth. Toronto, great country, great city. Family's back there. But St. Louis, I mean, you could make half as much money and live very well here. Mm-hmm. You know, the cost of living here is tremendous compared to Toronto. Just so many things. Other than family, Toronto didn't have near the things going for it that St. Louis had. So it was a pretty easy decision to stay in St. Louis. And love this town and become big. Never knew that I was going to be a big baseball fan, but I've turned into that since my daughter works for them. And then watching the Blues win the Stanley Cup, but again, we didn't know that we'd ever even in my life see it happen.
Well, for you that you're so ingrained with being in the same building as the Blues back in the day, did you, even though you never played within that organization, did you still feel kind of ingrained with it because you've been in the city this long? And as a fan, did you take some comfort in them winning after all these years?
I did, because it was a little bit later, but after I retired, they needed a goaltender, so I played alumni games and stuff for them. And then one night, I was at a game and I think Jablonski got hurt and Joseph went down, so I had to be the third man.
You're the E-bug. You know? Yeah.
And that was funny because I was with a buddy from college that's from Kansas City. And we had spent probably the last 3 hours before the game in the little White House next to the old rink, which is the bar.
Oh, good.
So we're both shit-faced. And I remember Bob Berry was the assistant coach. We're up in the alumni box. And, again, Jablonski goes down. I just know something's going to happen here, you know. Maybe I'm just drunk enough to realize something's going to happen.
You can't drink enough waters right there
sure
at
enough,
that point, right?
Phone rings, it's Bob Berry. And he's talking to Bruce Affleck or somebody. Like, hey, is Lindsay up there? Lindsay, we need you down here right away. And now I got guys feeding me coffee. I don't even drink. I hate coffee. Guys trying to feed me coffee and everything else. You know? I stumble down there and I have to sign a paper release or whatever. So that was close. I went to, thank God. Oh, so I'm second man in line now. Well, the second goaltender, whether it be Joseph or whoever it was, Riendo or whatever, during the course of the game, he goes down. And I, there's no one yelling in the stands more than me that, get up. So he turns out to be okay. So I never had to go in. But then I had a couple of times I had to go to Peoria. They call a guy up, emergency, somebody got hurt in the afternoon. I'd go to Peoria and sit on the bench behind the Peoria guy, and the Peoria guy would come to St. Louis and that. So I kind of got
You had a relationship with the team that way, right?
So yeah. Never was really, but a lot of the Blues alumni guys are treat you like you're been a Blues somewhat. You know?
Sure, yeah.
So that's kind of tying in. So yeah, you got a closeness to the Blues, and certainly that little love story of this current season is just hard not to fall in love with.
Pretty incredible.
The way it went, you know. Yeah.
For you to transition out and then do all the coaching that you did afterwards and really just at the youth level and some college, was it a good way for you to stay in the game while working your regular job and still feel connected to it?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think you ask most guys, what are you going to miss most about not playing? Not going to be the stopping shots, not going to be getting hurt in practice and taking them wherever. It's going to be the dressing room. It's going to be hanging with the guys, you know. So coaching can give you a way of not only helping kids and that, but selfishly keeping in the game, keeping young, keeping, you know, last 4 or 5 years of coaching college hockey, these kids are 22 to 25, 26 years of age, and they keep you young and they keep you, you know, you can kind of kid with them differently than you kid with 12-year-olds, you know.
Feel so a little better cursing in front of them,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. They're throwing it back at you pretty good, too. So,
right.
So it in its own way has been good. It's kept you young. It's kept you in the game. It's kept you in the dressing rooms, you know. And they all like to hear stories, so, you know, that comes out once in a while. I'm pretty good at not being too storytelling guy. You know, once we all sit around and have a couple of beers, they'll prod you a little bit more. And,
yeah.
What was Gretzky like?
Yeah, right. You know, so it's been a great one, but it's just like I said. But I do know that when you finally do lose that passion for that, I coached the last year. The wins didn't mean much. The losses didn't mean much. I actually felt that maybe I just wasn't giving my best to the game anymore. You know, I was cheating the kids a little bit. Still were successful. Still was going good. But just had no problem leaving. It's only been this season. As I was saying, it's the first time in 58 years that I haven't had hockey. And that's why we're heading to Florida for the summer. You're
taking the grand tour.
For the winter.
Yeah.
Exactly. So all my buddies out of Canada that always went to Florida for the winter, hey, Linz, can't you come on down for a week? I can't. I'm playing, you know, and stuff like that. So now I get to be a true Canadian, I guess.
That's great. You're a real snowbird now,
right,
even though you've been in St. Louis.
Exactly. So if they have enjoyed it, haven't missed it yet. Wife seems to think there's going to be a void. There is a void by being retired. Is that hockey took not only just being at the rink for a long time, but just the game plan, practice planning. What you'll find when you coach is that as a player, you thought hockey while you were there, but it didn't linger much after you left the rink, a little bit for a while of a bad game or whatever.
Yep.
But in general, an hour later, you're on to something else. They'll practice the next day. Coaching, it's 24-7. Oh, man, what if I had to move that guy over into this line? Or what if I mean, it's just 24-7. I can't get away from drawing up lineups or drawing up defensive pairs or who am I going to start in the net? Or I mean, that just is consuming to a coach 24-7. So there's a lot of time now that I've got to put in without that. So what takes up that void? Because that's 4, 5, 6 hours a day, if not more, depending on whatever. So we're still trying to work out the retirement schedule sort of thing. But it's a nice thing to be able to, now instead of working about drawing up lineups, I'm drawing up cruises that we're going to go on or whereabouts in the world we want to travel and stuff like that. So those are as fun as coaching.
That's a good feeling to have,
yeah,
isn't it? You've earned it.
I think so, buddy. I think so.
Well, on behalf of Bandanas, who hosted us today, this was Lunch with Gold Goalies, I guess.
X.
Yeah, X
Gold.
We're
never old.
No,
we're just former.
That's
former,
right.
X, whatever.
I like the way you look at it. Lindsay, I owe a huge debt of gratitude to you. You taught me all the basics to it and the things we accomplished together. I can't tell you how much it meant because I don't have my career without you. So,
Michael, I appreciate that. I tell you, it's amazing to me to have been a part of your life and to see how so many things were paralleled, you know. And best of luck with the new adventure in Vegas.
Thanks for listening to 6 Degrees with Mike McKenna. Please make sure that you like, comment, leave a rating, subscribe, whether it's iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, anywhere that you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.